Oftentimes, it's better to start with creativity to help you learn the facts.
Life is too short to learn a list of 1,000 rando words.
From the campus of Stanford University,
this is Schools In
with your hosts, Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope.
Welcome to Schools In. I'm Denise Pope, senior lecturer with the Graduate School of Education here at Stanford, and I am with my co-host, Dean Dan Schwartz.
Dr. Denise, which history Pope?
Which history? Which, like W-I-C-H or W-I-T-C-H?
I think W-H-I-C-H.
Oh, yeah, I spelled the first one wrong. Good job. What's up, Dan?
Well, we're going to be talking about history and education. And how do we represent history to children and how do we help children learn history?
So let me ask you this. When you were teaching, did you have some special magic sauce that you brought in that helped kids relate to history, their own histories?
Well, I wanted them to learn about their own histories and cultures. And I had three shots at it, and two failed, and one succeeded.
Okay, third time's a charm.
Yeah, third time. Well, the third time I had nothing to do with it.
Oh.
That's why it was a charm. But
okay, tell us what happened.
So the first time, I'm teaching in inner city Los Angeles, 99% African Americans. And the only textbook that I had was a 1954 grammar book.
What?
Yeah, so I was like the last teacher to get assigned, and there were no books left except for this grammar book. And I'm teaching English. So I started making copies of Go Tell It on the Mountain by Baldwin, and I would read it to the students, and it was really glorious. They would just stop, and I would just read this beautiful, but it had a lot of swear words, and my supervisor came in and heard all the swear words.
Oh, and like fired you on the spot.
No, but I was no longer teaching from that book. So that was a fail. So then I go to Alaska, and there, this small village, and they don't want to lose the culture, right? And they want children to be proud of their culture, even though it's under tremendous transition. So the first wave of anthropologists came through, and they said, we'll have everybody do dancing.
Oh boy.
Because dancing, you know, represents the culture. But in this culture, they didn't really dance. So it was just a complete misfire.
Wait, they made the kids dance?
Everybody, yeah.
You had to dance too?
No, yeah, a little bit.
Cultural appropriation.
I'm shy. But then they brought in another group of anthropologists who the school district hired them. And they came in and they interviewed the elders about their stories, about the transitions over time. You know, they were there when planes first showed up. There had been no planes.
Who was doing the interviewing?
The anthropologists.
The anthropologists.
And then they wrote these short books that were like 20 pages about each of the elders in all these villages. And it portrayed sort of, it made you proud of the elders. They had great wisdom. It would present them both in the English they knew, the best they knew, and the native language, and it had pictures, old pictures. And this was a wonderful thing.
That's awesome.
No, it was a great curriculum, but it really took someone who knew how to do this and knew why the point of having these books for these kids was.
How did the kids react?
Oh, they loved it.
They loved it?
And the elders loved it too.
Yeah.
You know, because they'd have pictures of them. They'd have the family tree, and the kids are like, that's my grandpa. But there was a tremendous respect for where these people had come from and what their society was doing and becoming. So it was very nice.
Very cool.
Yeah, it was really good.
Well, we are really lucky today because we have an expert here, Mike Hines, who's a professor in history and education. Actually, he is a historian of education, which we're going to talk about because that's kind of a funky thing that people don't really know what that is. Mike's research interests include the history of ed, curriculum studies, social studies, and civics education. His research currently focuses on how African Americans in the early 20th century created new curricular discourses around race and historical representation.
Excellent.
Yeah, it's going to be a good show. So, Mike, thank you for being here, and thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah. So, all right, let's start with the obvious question, which is, what the heck is a historian of education? What is it that you do?
I think that the easiest way to talk about history of education would be to say that historians of ed study the development of schools and school systems over time. So we study things like the curriculum and how it develops, pedagogy and how that develops, and practices around schooling and how they change over time.
And pedagogy is how people teach.
Mm-hmm.
So how that's changed over time.
Absolutely.
Has
absolutely.
It?
Well, that's a whole other show.
Oh, okay.
But like, if you were studying the history of Dan Schwartz, you would go from his, you know, Africa teaching to the LA failed experiment to the failed Alaska.
I'm not sure
Alaska
I qualify
experiment.
For a history thing, but thank you.
So let's kind of dive a little bit more deeply into what Dan and I were just talking about. Mm-hmm. What is why is it so important for people to have and hear histories about their own lives? Why do you think that worked in Alaska?
So like, I believe I had to take European history in high school. It didn't do much for me.
Because you're not from Europe?
Yes, and because pedagogies haven't changed for many, many years.
Oh, yes. Open the textbook to page 10. Yes. Read the paragraph, answer the questions, spit back on a test.
Well,
so, yeah.
I think that to start, it's important for people to hear their own histories and to be included in the curriculum, because the curriculum, especially history and social studies curricula, communicate a lot implicitly by who's excluded and who's included in the curriculum, about who and what we see America to be. Mm-hmm. And so for students to be able to see themselves in the curriculum is really about being able to see themselves as part of our national story and our national narrative, right? And so I think it's important to be able to showcase and to bring out the contributions of many different groups, whether that's ethnic groups, religious groups, racial groups, so that students can see that.
It's hugely important. And I also know it's so hard because teachers have lots of different kids in their classroom. So how do you hit, you know, this person is from here and this person's family is from here and this person is this religion and this, you know, what's a poor teacher to do?
I think, you know, teachers have to try their best. I think it's the responsibility, though, of also the people who are creating the curriculum, the people who are writing the textbooks and making the materials to sort of broaden the coverage and broaden the story that gets told in schools. And so, you know, it's sort of a responsibility on all of us. It's a responsibility on the people who train teachers, but also on the teachers themselves and also on the people who are providing the materials to try and include as many voices as possible.
This was the story in Alaska, right? There was no curriculum for this group, for the Athabascan Indians. There was no curriculum. So when you're a historian, mm-hmm. when did the first inclusive curriculum show up?
Wow.
Or is that may be the wrong
word.
Inclusive may not be the right.
No, that's a really good question, because inclusiveness has not always been a goal of the American school system, I think, you know. So a lot of scholars would probably trace that into the 60s and 70s with, you know, calls for ethnic studies programs and calls for more inclusive curricula then. But actually the story of that sort of curricula goes a lot further back into the early 20th century, even. And a lot of my research deals with movements for more inclusive curricula that came about in the 1930s and 1940s, during the Depression and during the Second World War specifically, which was a time when sort of Americans, you know, saw themselves as needing to pull together to defeat sort of a common enemy, right? An outside enemy in sort of fascist Germany. And so the schools were really responsible for trying to bring students of different ethnic backgrounds together sort of under this rally around the flag mentality. And so that's part of where this push for sort of multicultural or more inclusive curricula comes from.
This is Schools In with Denise Pope and Dan Schwartz. We're talking today with Mike Hines, a professor in history and education, about inclusive curriculum and bringing people in. I didn't realize it went that far back.
Absolutely.
You'd think we'd be better at it then if we've been doing it this long, Mike.
Well, No, that's interesting that it was an outside force. And did this rise through the military, or was it in the air, so to speak?
It was in the air. It was promoted by the federal government. It was promoted by what was at that time the Office of Education. It wasn't a department yet. It wasn't a cabinet level position. Mm-hmm. But the Office of Education promoted it to the schools. And it was, you know, it was part of the popular culture as well. So, you know, since we're on radio right now, there was actually a very famous at its time show on radio called Americans All, Immigrants All.
Mm-hmm. Nice.
Which came on. Yes. Came on for 28 straight weeks, I believe, in the early 1940s. And so every Sunday, radio listeners would be able to gather around on Sunday night and hear from CBS Radio, you know, this is Americans All, Immigrants All. And it would, each episode focused on another ethnic group or religious group. So, you know, this
wow.
week, the Negro, you know,
wow.
stay tuned next week for, you know, Italians.
Oh, and, my gosh.
And
who,
so,
who would they, but they'd get experts or they'd bring, who?
Mm-hmm. They would get experts, educators, actors, you know, there were little
wow.
vignettes and radio plays. And it was an incredibly popular show. It received, you know, hundreds of thousands of pieces of mail from different people who really expressed that, you know, for the first time they were hearing that they were part of the American story, you know, as well.
That's it's like, so cool.
It's like the first curriculum, but it didn't come through the schools.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So how about the schools? Did Chicago was important in this?
No, absolutely. So a lot of cities, New York, Chicago, Detroit, San Diego, all launch programs in what they call at that point intercultural education. My work centers on Chicago and with a really influential curriculum writer, a black woman named Madeline Morgan, who launched sort of the first black history curriculum to be adopted in the Chicago public schools. And so she's responsible for advocating for this, for writing it, creating it, and then getting it adopted by CPS. And this is, you know, a decade before Brown versus Board of Education. But this
curriculum. Let's just, for our listeners who might not know what Brown versus Board versus Education is, can you just give us a 2 seconds?
Right, absolutely. Brown v. Board is sort of the Supreme Court case that declares separate but equal schooling to be unconstitutional and opens the gateway for school integration. So this is, you know, a decade prior to that, because Brown v. Board is 1954, and this is in the 40s. And a decade before that, this inclusive curriculum is being used in Chicago's public schools for both black students and white students to learn more about African-American history and culture.
This is Schools In with Denise Pope and Dan Schwartz. We're talking with Mike Hines about inclusivity, inclusive education way back when in Chicago that kind of led the way before Brown versus Board of Education. Now, when they were teaching the white kids and the black kids, they were still in separate schools at this
yes.
point.
Yes.
So, but it was the same curriculum. They actually allowed this woman's curriculum to go into both the white kids' classes and the black kids' classes?
Yes, absolutely.
That's shocking to me.
Something that was, yeah, that was fairly incredible for its time. And Morgan's curriculum was picked up on not just in the sort of academic press, but also in the popular press. She graces the pages of Time magazine. It's, you know, as an expert on race relations.
It must have been a great curriculum.
It was excellent. It's got a lot of things in it that still aren't part of, you know, primary school curricula, social studies mm-hmm. curricula.
But that should be?
Yes.
So can you give us an example of that?
Yeah. For instance, she complicates sort of the narratives around slavery in America. She includes coverage of not just African Americans as slaves, but also free African Americans in the years before the Civil War and what they were doing. And also she talks about slave revolts and resistance by enslaved people themselves. And so she gives a more full picture of what African Americans were up to in the years before the Civil War, instead of just focusing in on slavery itself.
So how were people not freaking out about this? I mean, I look at today and it's such a controversial topic, even still today. Back then,
like teaching about the Holocaust.
Yeah. Or just any kind of, you know, bringing in the other is just mm-hmm. a fraught, you know, and there's people who say, I'm not skilled to do this. You know, I'm not a black teacher. I can't teach black history. You know, you hear all sorts of crazy things. I can't imagine that there wasn't like this outcry, particularly from the white parents, to be honest, that what are you not teaching when you're bringing in this curriculum about those kids?
Right. I think that definitely there were some teachers who resisted bringing this sort of curriculum into the public schools. I think a lot of that just happened through teachers taking the curriculum and just refusing to use it.
Well, that happens today too.
Right. You know, just there's definitely a difference between the curriculum that's intended and that's put out there and then what teachers actually, you know, actualize in their classrooms and teach. So
Denise, do you think the pushback is as strong as the pushback around teaching evolution?
I think we should ask a historian about that. I don't know. I know there's pushback around everything.
I don't think the historian is going to be willing to say there's a 33% pushback and a 50% pushback on evolution.
There's, depending on what region you are in the U.S., the whole state of Texas has rules about teaching creationism and evolution, I can only imagine.
Mm-hmm. Yep. There's... I think there's always pushback about issues that we find it sort of difficult or potentially divisive to talk about in schools. And I think there's a challenge that teachers have to face in learning how to be comfortable with these uncomfortable topics, right? And that's something that we still need to work on is as teachers, as educators, as parents, as students, is being comfortable sitting in that place of sort of discomfort. It's a lot easier to just, you know, open up sort of a canned curriculum, have the answers right there, and be able to sort of just move on.
Yeah. And I think there's fear. What if I do this wrong? What if I upset someone? What if I'm not politically correct? Mm-hmm. But I also think there's fear of what can of worms is this going to open up when the kids realize that, like, the system is, you know, not a meritocracy or, you know, all these big things. I think there's that double whammy fear.
Yeah. And I hear that a lot. I hear about that sort of pushback of, you know, I don't want to teach this because, you know, it's sort of disrupting what my students think about America, about our national past. And I think that, you know, the two ways to answer that is one, we can't sort of cling to sort of myths about America being sort of a flawless, you know, country that's always in the right. Right. You know, we have to be able to go beyond that and to question that. And that's one of the things that teaching histories of people who have been marginalized historically does, is it allows us to question and to challenge that sort of American exceptionalism myth that we've all grown up with. The second thing, I think, is that, you know, for all the teachers who say that, you know, maybe teaching this will somehow upset their students, I think that they're not giving their students enough credit.
This is Schools In with Denise Pope and Dan Schwartz. We will have more with Mike Hines and teaching our kids some uncomfortable things and some stuff that maybe they already know and the teachers should get over. More inclusive curriculum when we come back with Mike next on Sirius XM.
This is Schools In.
I'm not an expert at this. Okay. I'm more expert than you.
When you can't read in American society, you are really left out.
With Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope from the campus of Stanford University.
Welcome back to Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope. We are talking with Mike Hines, who is a professor of history and education, about how to teach in a more inclusive way. We've got a lot of different kids in the classroom, and they need to see themselves in the history.
So we left off, if I remember perfectly, that Mike was saying that it's important for kids to be exposed to moldable narratives and that they can handle this. We need to give them credit.
Even when it's kind of tough and makes them feel like maybe their people weren't very nice to some other people who are sitting right next to them in the classes.
This is not Disney, Walt Disney's history.
Yeah. Right?
So, of course, Denise, this came from a historian whose whole job is to negotiate multiple narratives. And
yes,
that's what he does. And so he may be overestimating what kids can do.
Oh.
So my question to you is, what age would you start sort of myth busting? Where you start letting kids know?
I think right from the start, Dan. I mean, look, kids know that kids are different from them. When they see it, and they at a very young age will ask, "Why is that person's skin color different from mine?" Then, as a parent, you got to start to go into that stuff. You can't just smooth it over.
I'm not sure I agree with you.
Okay, well, Dan, this is like the first time on the show that that's ever happened. Do tell.
No, I just remember my son, who is Native American. He's like 10 or 11. And I mentioned, you know, you're Native American. And he's saying, yeah. Am I what? Mm-hmm. There was nothing associated with it. Of course, his dad's a white guy. So maybe that's why it wasn't in his face. But
yeah,
I'm not sure at what age you begin to notice these differences.
Well, I think we should ask the expert.
Well, Mike, he's a historian. He knows about decades. He doesn't know about...
No. He's still grown up in the U.S. Tell us, Mike. Tell us.
Well, I think I would agree with you, Denise.
See? Ha, 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 ha. Just kidding.
The earlier, the better, as far as starting to talk to kids and starting to be honest with students and with our own kids about sort of the complicated nature of America's history. And Dan, I like that you said that, you know, this isn't the Disney version of American history. Now, right, there's obviously only so far you can go with students before, you know, it's not developmentally appropriate. It's not appropriate for their age.
Right.
And, you know, we have to be cautious around that. But I think that, you know, even at a very young age, students are ready to handle concepts that are a little bit more complicated than we give them credit for usually. I also want to say that, you know, just to add to something or maybe to push back on something that we've been talking about, I think that it's definitely important for students who may have been marginalized to hear their voices in the curriculum and see themselves in their curriculum. But I think it's just as important for students who are in the majority to learn those stories too, because otherwise they grow up with a distorted view of the history of their country, which can hurt them just as much, right? So this sort of education is for all students and equally important for everyone.
I think, and you know what, that's a piece that doesn't get talked about a lot, but you start to hear this idea of white guilt and the kids who feel guilty that by the very nature of who they are or who their relatives were, that they caused pain on others. And it's a side of the story that you don't hear a lot about. I don't know. What do you make of that?
I think I think as teachers, as educators, we have to find ways to teach that don't cast blame, right, on students or make students feel that they are to blame for different historical actions that honestly they had nothing to do with, obviously, but that we teach in ways that inform kids about how the legacy of those historical facts still impacts them today. I think that's sort of the key. Not that students should feel guilt or feel shame, but that they should recognize the ways in which things that happened in the past still impact what's going on in the present and some of the privilege that they carry because of maybe, you know, things in the past.
This is Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope. We're speaking with Mike Hines, professor in history and education, about teaching some tough narratives about what happened in the past and multicultural and inclusive education.
I want to go back to the CBS wartime radio show. Mm-hmm. And there the approach to teaching was to sort of bring in different groups and celebrate their uniqueness, their accomplishments, their immigrants. Somewhere along the line, the approach is now, no, we need to talk about slavery and what that was, which is a very mm-hmm. different approach. And so I assume that came later in mm-hmm. in being introduced. So you probably were just at the time when people were starting to introduce those conversations. Did you experience this? You're a lot younger than some of us in the room.
You can say both of us. It's okay.
Well, I definitely, you know, I think we're still dealing with how to have those conversations in classrooms, and I think that still in American schools, continues to be a lot of this sort of surface level multiculturalism that focuses on, you know, food and
dancing
yeah. and styles of dress and, you know, these very sort of surface level things, and sort of skirts over or pushes to the side issues that are more uncomfortable to talk about, like inequality and inequity and racism and prejudice and all of these things that are really tough to grapple with. I think that, you know, on top of that, you know, we talked about how teachers are sometimes uncomfortable and not well trained to do that sort of heavy lifting with their students themselves. And, you know, every school year there is a flood of stories about teachers teaching American slavery in ways that are questionable, that are really honestly pretty horrible because they haven't been trained. So, you know, whether it's, you know, auctioning off one group of students to another group of students, or, you know,
simulations
or games that are based around these subjects, or, you know, growing up in Louisville, Kentucky, we actually had a field trip experience where we were made to act like slaves. Far from the only state and school district in the union where that sort of, you know, role playing and things happened. So I think that, you know, we're still struggling with how to teach those topics.
So do you design curriculum at all in your work? Or so, like, I know you chronicled the story of this amazing woman who got, is she now going to be in a curriculum that you design where she becomes kind of a hero for the rest of us?
I hope so. I hope, you know, that telling the story of this teacher, Madeline Morgan, and telling how she was able to sort of elicit change, way back in the 1930s and 1940s, right, that we can learn from her accomplishments, but also learn from the limitations that she faced. And I'm really looking forward to taking it back to Chicago and talking with, you know, current day social studies teachers and history teachers.
Awesome.
And getting their feedback.
Thank you so much for being here, Mike.
No problem.
And thank all of you for listening to Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope. If you missed any of this episode, listen anytime on demand with the SiriusXM app on iTunes and SoundCloud.
From the campus of Stanford University, this has been Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope on SiriusXM Business Radio. If you missed any of it, listen on demand, online, or with the SiriusXM app.